It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Sunflowers are blooming in Wisconsin in the upper Midwest. According to the National Sunflower Association, our neighbor Minnesota recorded the largest increase among states harvesting sunflowers last year, with North Dakota leading the nation. So closer to home, join the conversation about Wisconsin sunflower fields. Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Bart Sopa is a fourth-generation farmer who grows 70 acres of sunflowers at the Sopa Fairview Farm in the community of Amherst in central Wisconsin. Bart, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. So can you describe what your fields look like today?
Well, they're a big yellow field of sunflowers.
So as you look out, those sunflowers, they're growing each day. What are the changes like as they come into bloom?
Well, the common misconception is that the sunflower follows the sun, but I didn't find it until I planted the field. Once they bloom, they no longer follow the sun. They just stay facing east.
Why is that?
I don't have an answer for that.
How about the drought and the, you know, we've had so little rain, the heat, what impact has that had on your sunflower fields?
It has had a huge impact. If you'd have talked to me 3 weeks ago, I was afraid I wasn't going to have a sunflower crop to view. Hadn't had a decent rain since they were planted. We got 1.75 inches last weekend that really pushed them through. The heads are smaller than previous years because of the drought, but they are... they're looking good and pretty, even though they're slightly shorter and smaller flowers than, or smaller bloom than normal.
Do you still have the sturdy stalks? Do they feel pretty rigid for you?
Yes, they are. They're strong and for their height, they the stalks aren't as big as, the bigger the head, the bigger the stalk.
And you invite people to enjoy your sunflower fields as long as they're respectful of the plants. What can people do in your fields?
Mostly now, I don't have, everybody always asks what else I have. They want me to have a petting zoo and whatever else. Basically, just to come out and enjoy the sunflowers. I do sell some of my sunflower oil product at the field, but mostly just come hang out. Enjoy the view. We have added a few unique things this year. This coming weekend, we're going to have coffee in the field at sunrise if people want to come and have a cup of coffee and see the sunflowers in the morning sun.
Oh, that just sounds so glorious. I love it. You talk about oils, sunflower oil. Do you make that or do you send your seeds out? How does that work?
As of right now, I send the seed out to a friend that presses it for me. I hope in the future to be pressing it on farm, but right now I just send it out.
How do the seeds get to market and how are they graded? What is that like for harvesting them?
This is my 16th year of growing sunflowers. Over the years, I've attempted to go through the typical market of a bird seed company and haven't had any luck as far as what they want. So in the past, I've sold to my personal feed mill, but 3 years ago, I just started marketing myself direct to the customer right off the farm, have a few local places that carry it for me and retail it, but mostly just off the farm.
Mostly off the farm. And what about ensuring like weed control with sunflowers? Do you have to deal with weeds or apply any herbicides?
Yes. That has been my biggest challenge in all these years of growing sunflowers is not a lot of people in the industry know how to handle them fertilizer-wise, weed-wise, and I've had to experiment and Try the things that work. And more recently, some of the people I work with, the agronomists, have looked into it more, especially with more people around growing them, to have options for what I can use for herbicide and fertilizers needed to grow them and such.
We're talking about sunflowers. Bart Sopa here, owner of Sopa Fairview Farm in Amherst. As the blooms are starting to peak, you can join in on sunflower harvesting, sunflower fields, where you go. The number to join in with your question or comment is 800-642-1234. Now, Bart, we're going to bring in someone who is near and dear to your heart. Faith, your daughter, is here. Hi, Faith.
Hi.
What do you love about growing sunflowers on the farm?
There's so many reasons. It's seeing them bloom and seeing everyone want to come out and enjoy it with us, along with just being a memorial for my brothers also.
Oh, wow. Can you talk a little bit about the meaning of these sunflowers to your family?
Well, my parents gave birth to twin boys in the summer of 2007, and they were born prematurely, and shortly after, they both ended up passing away.
Mm.
And my dad did start growing the sunflowers before them, but then decided that they would be a memorial for my brothers also, along with everything else that we've built onto it with the oil and selling it for bird seed. And it's just become this huge thing that we didn't expect it to turn into.
Oh, that's a beautiful story. And I'm so sorry. When you look out at the fields, what do you think about as those sunflowers come into bloom? What goes through your mind as you look at your farm?
Honestly, nothing. It's just like a peaceful nothing.
A peaceful
kind of
nothing.
Appreciating everything around and nothing.
Bart, your farm has been in the family for 130 years. Can you tell us about the history of the farm?
Well, my great-grandfather bought the farm in 1893. My grandpa, my dad all farmed it. I bought it from my dad in 06. We were dairy farmers. Unfortunately, the economy of 2008 and 9 pushed me out of dairy in 2010, forced me to get an off-farm job. Was able to hold on to the property, and now financially in a better position over the last 5 years to get back to, I was renting out the land, now working back into working it myself and getting some more cattle again. I also recently got a job at a Warzel and Sons potato farm in Plover. So I'm not only farming in my off farm job, but or my out of home job, but my farm at home, and hope to get my farm back to a place where my daughter can farm full time.
Was it a difficult decision to quit dairy farming?
Yes, it was not. I did not by choice. It was a financial force out. I'm probably the only former dairy farmer that you talk to that wishes he was still milking cows. Everybody else is glad they don't milk cows anymore, but I miss the cows.
Mm. May I ask, Faith, you're 15, is that right?
Yes.
Yes. What do you think about the tradition of handing down farms to the next generation? And what are your thoughts on that?
I think, I don't know. I'm happy to take it over for my family, and I want to be able to pass it down to my kids. But today, with there not being as many family farms, it's kind of hard for people to get that information and get the experience that I've had growing up. And I think we, as a community, need to find a way to experience this with the next generation, including myself.
Faith, what are your chores on the farm? What do you do on a day-to-day basis?
It varies. Most of it is taking care of my cows because they are my show cows through FFA. So hay and water throughout the day, making sure they always have food in front of them, and cleaning up after them.
When will you show them next?
Actually, I'm taking one of my newest calves to Marshfield Fair at the end of this month.
Okay. Do you feel like you're ready for it?
Not at all.
Oh, okay. Bart, I heard that, you know, cows like to graze on sunflowers. Do they eat the stalks? What do they eat? Oh, Bart, are you there? I think we're having a connection issue. Okay, we're going to just take a moment here as we talk with Bart Sopa and daughter Faith about sunflowers on Sopa Fairview Farm in Amherst. There are guides to sunflower blooms, the harvest for oil and seeds. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sunflowers are in bloom. Farms around Wisconsin are showing off their fields of stately yellow beauties that draw us in for selfies, for family portraits, maybe oils made on the farm. Call in with your question or comment about growing sunflowers. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Bart Sopa and his daughter Faith on having sunflower fields, 70 acres on Sopa Fairview Farm in Amherst. Let's bring on a call now. Bob is joining us from Marshfield. Hi, Bob. What's on your mind?
Hey, I was just wondering, what kind of occasions get celebrated out in the sunflowers? Do people come out and, like, get engaged, get married in the sunflowers, or do you just got to come out for random occasion?
Bob, thanks so much. Bart, what brings them to you?
Bob or anybody, everybody comes out. Senior pictures there in the field last year had a couple that had a wedding in the neighborhood, brought the whole wedding party out for pictures. The last 2 years I've had a lot of people want to be politically correct. I don't know if they were of Hmong heritage or Asian, exactly what heritage. I think they had a holiday that's going on because they came out dressed in amazingly bright dresses and clothes and had pictures taken celebrating something. I didn't ask what exactly.
A type of holiday, yes.
But
Faith, how do you help visitors on the farm, and what is your role when the newcomers come to see the sunflowers?
I try my hardest to make sure they know our story and make sure they feel welcome and just sit by my grandma and we just talk all day.
Oh, I love that. What has your grandma taught you about farms, and what stories do you like to share with your grandma?
Well, if anyone knows my grandma, they know that she loves to talk. So I've heard a lot about her childhood and her life with my grandpa on the farm. But I think my favorite story was hearing about her and the horses on the farm, because I've always loved horses. And then when I got my own horse, then my grandma would always tell me about the draft horses that they had on the farm and how scared she was of them. And it's just interesting to see.
What is your horse's name?
Sheriff.
Sheriff. Oh, I love it. So, Bart, how challenging is farming sunflowers compared to other crops?
I wouldn't say it's any more or any less than anything. Every crop has its requirements and needs, and they're all different, yet they all need nutrients, they all need water, and as farmers, we want to keep the competition, that would be the weeds and pests and whatnot, out away so that they can thrive to their peak.
How do sunflowers fit in as a rotational crop? Are they considered a decent cover crop?
I know a lot of guys use them as cover crop. I know a lot of guys use them in their deer plots, because I see it in my own field. The deer love them, eat them long before they have flowers. They fit my rotation, I guess, well. That's really has been, before the last 4 years, it's been more of a fun thing and tribute to my boys that's turned into now more of it's the base of the farm at the time, right now.
Do the sunflowers as a cover crop, do they keep soil in place better, do you think? Or is it just more like a typical rotational crop?
As far as the cover crop angle, I don't know specifically the reason. Cover crops have become more and more a big thing nowadays, and I'm learning and hoping to use them more, because the majority of my farm is no-till.
Okay.
So the cover crop thing comes into play. I have a neighbor that's very knows a lot about cover crops, and I've been trying to find time to work with him and learn more.
We're talking. Go ahead.
I just know some guys have gotten seed from me to use it for their cover crop mix, and I guess I never asked why they use it as a cover crop.
Just learning as you go. Bart Sopa here as we talk about sunflower fields, and Faith Sopa, daughter, as they talk about Sopa Fairview Farm in Amherst. You can join in with your questions about sunflowers, 800-642-1234. Faith, what would you think about if your family expanded the number of acres of growing sunflowers? Do you feel like 70 acres is a good fit, or can it go more?
I feel like we could go more, just to be bigger and better.
Bart, what do you think of that?
We definitely have room to go with more. I just need to get set up to handle the volume of seed.
Is the market for sunflower seeds getting bigger in Wisconsin?
I don't think it's getting bigger per se. It just, there's not a huge acreage grown in Wisconsin, so it all gets brought here from the Dakotas. Or not all of it, most of it.
Those leading states, North Dakota, the biggest harvester in the nation, Minnesota right behind as well. Should Wisconsin farmers expand their production of sunflowers, do you think?
If it fits their operation, right now there's really not a lot of elevators. I don't think there's any elevators that would take it. They'd have to find an out for it, which isn't here. And then that's why I sell off the farm, as I don't per se have a place to go like you do with corn or soybeans. There's grain elevators all over that you can haul it to and sell it.
the infrastructure would need to be there. Yeah.
Correct. And I could see that changing. And I know I didn't realize till the Russian-Ukraine war stuff in the recent year. So how many acres and how much sunflowers is used in Russia and the Ukraine area. Sunflower oil is a common staple there.
Well, Bart and Faith, thank you so much for joining us. Bart Sopa, daughter Faith, they are farmers growing 70 acres of sunflowers at Sopa Fairview Farm in the community of Amherst in central Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Police pursuits are becoming more common in Milwaukee. The city's police department engaged in more than 1,000 chases last year, an average of nearly 3 a day. And Jonah Chester reports that as chases have increased, so have injuries to innocent third parties.
On August 1st, 2019, 19-year-old Laquan McCoy was driving through an intersection on Milwaukee's north side. Another driver in a stolen SUV blew through a flashing red light going about 70 miles per hour and into the driver's side of McCoy's car. The impact sent McCoy's Jeep into a tree on one side of the road and a parked car on the other, killing him. Antoinette Broomfield is McCoy's mother.
My husband ended up passing away from stress, from a heart attack, from just constantly being in pain and worrying about it. My other children, my daughter, she's not the same. She's different. My son, he's not the same. Everybody is grieving.
Aaron Fitzgerald was driving that stolen SUV and fleeing police. He got a 10-year prison sentence and 8 years of extended supervision for McCoy's death. But Broomfield's quest for accountability didn't end with his imprisonment. She's suing the city of Milwaukee and the four officers who pursued Fitzgerald. Sitting with her attorney, she says those officers could have called off the chase earlier, avoiding the tragedy.
Oh, some days I just don't even want to get out the bed. Some days it's just bad. Some days I just wake up and I just wish it all was a dream. I know everybody make a mistake, but why could I even just get an apology that it happened to my child?
Broomfield's lawsuit comes as police chases in Milwaukee are becoming more common. Annual pursuit rates in the early 2010s generally hovered around 50 chases a year. In both 2021 and 2022, officers pursued more than 1,000 suspects. Pursuit reform advocates attribute that surge to the department's current chase policy. It allows officers to pursue for more offenses like reckless driving. In the early 2010s, the department had a stricter policy. Officers could usually only chase those suspected of a felony. Craig Sarnow is an inspector with the Milwaukee Police Department. He says policy changes through the 2010s allowed officers to address drug dealing, reckless driving, carjacking, and other crimes.
We used to have individuals that would try to bait Milwaukee police officers into getting into pursuits, knowing full well that we couldn't because our policy was so restrictive.
But advocates say a looser chase policy also puts more innocent people, like Laquan McCoy, at risk. From 2007 to 2022, uninvolved bystanders were injured in more than 3 times as many police chases as officers were. And that data may not provide the full picture. Jonathan Ferris is the chief advocate for the Wisconsin-based Pursuit for Change. He says police chase data is often inaccurate.
Most of us who have been following this for a fair number of years have seen more than enough examples of pursuits that were not logged as pursuits.
And police departments do have other options. Things like high-tech trackers, tire deflation tools, and even a grappling device that allows an officer to entangle a fleeing vehicle and slow it down. But MPD Chief of Staff Nicholas Desiato told the city's Fire and Police Commission last summer that many of those alternatives are, quote, practically impractical.
They can be effective when appropriate. But it also requires incredible coordination and sometimes just dumb luck. In terms of for the hot pursuit to effectively combat reckless driving, it's just a necessary tool.
Sarnow says the department is open to reviewing the current chase policy, but he doesn't expect it to change anytime soon. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about federal legislation to support seed and animal breeding research tailored to different regions of the country that could boost seed hardiness and farmer yields. Democratic U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin introduced the Seeds and Breeds for the Future Act earlier this summer. As we explore plant and animal breeding, call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Anthony Ponke is vice president of the Wisconsin-based advocacy group Family Farm Defenders and worked on the Fond du Lac area farm his family still owns. Anthony, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So Senator Baldwin's legislation would set aside $75 million for research directed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the research would aim to develop these new seed varieties at public research universities. Why is more funding needed for seed research?
Well, I think one thing is over the years, maybe the last couple decades, really, we've seen public institutions and so on, these are land grant institutions kind of becoming more and more, well, serving more and more corporations, private interests, and so on. And this legislation sets aside money that these, that public institutions can actually, at least in part, like fulfill their mission, producing seeds that working with the community also. It's like, it's not just dedicating resources for research, which is key, but also cultivating relationships with people in the community, farmers, can be businesses as well, to help diversify our food system. So that's key.
What are the concerns with the currently available seed varieties?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One thing is this lack of genetic diversity. In terms of, and then resilience is something, especially with climate change and drought and all these other things, extreme weather and so on, that more and more, when the genetic variety of our seeds is, well, diminished, they're going more homogenous around the country or even around the world. Like, and we have different weather patterns, different needs in different regions. Like, we need to have that kind of diversity. And it's also just like, not just with the diversity question, there's also prices. I think, most folks at the grocery store see, inflation impacting, food, your prices, what you're paying at the store and so on. And while you don't maybe see what farmers are doing, like what they're paying for seeds has been going up as well the last couple of decades. And so like they passed that cost off onto the consumer then, which we see at the grocery store. And so this is an issue that promoting research helps us environmentally, it also helps farmers with their bottom line in terms of promoting competition. Something like, I think you look around the country, you look around the world too, like when we talk about genetic diversity, we're talking about like also you can say like corporate control, homogenization, where fewer and fewer companies are controlling the seed markets. And then you have all these issues with price fixing, collusion, stuff like that. And so this is also, this is federal legislation, could be part of the farm bill, could be standalone legislation. And President Biden had launched a task force earlier in the year to investigate more what can be done about seeds and inputs in general. So there's a complicated web here without this just, one part.
One piece of that web, I want to go back to climate change, because we see the heat waves, the droughts, these extreme storms that are really stressing the fields, stressing plants that we depend on for our food system. Can we adapt our seeds and breeds enough to keep up with climate change?
That's the hope. I think the in terms of like adapting and for the varieties and the regions and not just seeds and the animal breeds and livestock, like I think we have to be flexible. We have to take in consideration the knowledge that we have now, the ancestral knowledge too I talk about in the article I wrote, but also just like we're talking about generations in the past. There's communities, indigenous communities also that have seed banks who've collected seeds that have grown into plants that have survived, that have adapted for generations. Like, working with that knowledge is going to be key as we deal with climate change. And this legislation brings together the key stakeholders in our communities who have that knowledge, who've retained it, and that can work together into creating varieties. I mean, with climate change, we see like temperatures changing. We see like the extreme weather events. We also just see like these gradual temperature changes, right, in different regions where, you know, we see that, I think farmers see that particularly where your falls are getting wetter, your springs are getting shorter. And so we're going to need to work together in terms of finding things like that can grow in those kinds of environments. And so, I mean, will we do that? Well, we have to. So that's kind of like what this legislation, I think, is going to be key in terms of like getting us together to figuring these problems out.
I want to acknowledge what you said there about indigenous foodways and you know, just imagining through the history of agriculture, you know, thousands of years growing season after growing season, and farmers and people tending the land, gradually modifying their crops by saving and planting the seeds of the plants that produce like the best fruit and you know, the most productive yields. Can you speak to this natural evolution of optimizing crops versus what happens today in the lab?
Mm-hmm. Well, personally, I don't have like, you know, in terms of like a story or I can't speak to it necessarily personally. I know like for our organization, Family Farm Defenders, we have every year we have a John Kinsman Prize, our founder, one of the people who created the organization, John Kinsman. It's the John Kinsman Food Sovereignty Prize. And one year, a few years ago, there was a farmer out in Minnesota who had, I believe, was approached by Winona LaDuke from White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. And they had found some seeds, some corn seeds there that were buried, that they had found somewhere in the reservation. And they approached a farmer who had this great land and never used chemicals and everything. And they had found these very old seeds, and then they asked him to plant them and see what happens. And this person did that. And they grew into this like form of corn that has just like, and it had been tested. I'm not sure, but with University of Minnesota or Wisconsin, but the corn had been tested. It grew way bigger than any other corn we typically have, but it also had all these different kinds of nutrients and so on. And, you know, those seeds were from, we don't know how long ago. Those seeds were not bought in a store. I mean, those seeds and grew into incredible plants. And in part, in those plants, that corn, that crop that grew from those seeds, I believe they've been working with it since then. But that was stuff that had right there, you could see like the wealth of in the plant, but in the historical knowledge that had been maintained by people over generations in cultivating those seeds, cultivating those plants, keeping that alive. And in the laboratory, you're going to have companies that, you know, especially with genetically modified organisms and so on, that are working on also this question of dealing with climate, you know, droughts and all that, making drought resistant varieties and so on. People have been doing that for a while, but then you have the companies doing this, and those varieties are patented restricts, you know, and they're called like utility patents. And that's something that this legislation, the seeds that would be developed under this legislation can't be patented in that kind of way. And when you have that kind of concentration, then you have, you know, issues in terms of access and so on.
Well, thank you for sharing that story from Minnesota. Anthony Ponke with us, vice president of the group Family Farm Defenders, a mission to create a farmer-controlled and consumer-oriented food system. Join the conversation about seed diversity in food crops. Call in with a question. Share a comment. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Seed biodiversity may help make food systems more resilient to climate change. A bill in Congress called the Seeds and Breeds for the Future Act It would promote the development of new seed varieties and animal breeds tailored to regions of the country and bred for environmental resilience. Be part of this discussion along the way. Call in with a question, bring a concern, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Anthony Ponke, who is with the Wisconsin grassroots group Family Farm Defenders and an associate professor of international relations at San Francisco State University. Let's take a call now. Jeff in Delafield is here. Jeff, hi. What would you like to ask?
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if this program will address the, could address or will explicitly address the overuse of fertilizers on crop fields. We have a very serious problem in central Wisconsin with groundwater contamination due to overuse of fertilizers. Lots of residential wells with unsafe drinking water due to nitrates, and what were once crystal clear trout streams are increasingly being choked with weeds and algae, and lakes becoming polluted due to nitrates coming in through the spring water. And this all seems to have corresponded with our increased reliance on biofuels due to all the fertilizer that's required to grow corn. So will this program address the issue of excessive fertilizer use?
Jeff, thank you for that question. Yes, Anthony.
No, it's a great question, and definitely, and I hear you in terms of the concern and everything you mentioned there. The legislation doesn't have anything to do with, I mean, directly, there's nothing in there about fertilizer use. I mean, I can imagine, I mean, the idea would be, hopefully, that when, in terms, like, so the concern that you raised, like, the idea would be, with the, as this legislation is not just about putting money into ag, into seed production. That's key. That's part of it. There's $75 million. That's part of, could be in the research title in the farm bill, but the legislation is also meant to bring people together. You know, that's, you know, kind of like democratize the food system in a certain way. So like the idea would be, you have the concern about fertilizers. You live in a certain area of the country. You could connect with, whether it's with farmers, with extension agents, make your voice heard, and then people can work together on creating seeds that may not require the kind of fertilizers or the amount that that are being currently used. And so, like, that's part, like, that's where part of the legislation is key in that regard, in that it is money, but it's also about getting people involved, right? That's the public mission. That's, you know, we have land grant institutions. Public institutions, that means they work with the public, you know, they're not top down. They should be, you know, it's a mutually beneficial relationship. So like there's a chance that this legislation could impact that by getting people involved in developing seed technology together.
Jeff had mentioned corn, and the state agriculture department says Wisconsin is among, you know, the nation's top exporter of ginseng roots, cranberries, and sweet corn. And we're producing millions of pounds of snap beans and carrots, green peas. Which crops are most in need of greater genetic diversity?
Well, that's a great question. Corn is up there. So if you look at corn, wheat, a lot of these varieties, there's a lot of, so yeah, there's a lot of production. But then I think you have to think of, I think what Jeff mentioned too, like the inputs that go into that production. We can see, you know, sales and the earnings, but then, you know, what are the real costs of food production? What's the real cost of the corn that we're producing in terms of the environmental? I mean, we say, and it's, I don't know if we want to frame it exactly in terms of cost, but like the, you know, the challenges that growing food the way that we do, what goes into it, we have to rethink that. And so corn, there's, you know, ever fewer varieties of corn that we have that are available in terms of seeds, in terms of what people buy too, in terms of sweet corn and so on. But, you know, like particularly with field corn, which goes into feed and so on, and that is exported, you know, the varieties of that, I mean, so much is dominated by, or is GM crops at this point.
Genetically
modified.
I mean,
modified. You're right. We could see more diversity in terms of that for sure.
I was going to jump in here as we talk about efforts to expand research of plant and animal breeding. Anthony Ponke with us, vice president of the Wisconsin-based group Family Farm Defenders, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jane in Suamico now. Jane, hi.
I'm so glad you have this guest on, and the work they're doing is incredibly important. I wonder if he could speak to the stranglehold huge corporations have on seeds and the fact that they patent the seeds and then prevent farmers from keeping seeds from one year to the next to regrow their next crops.
Jane, thank you so much for that question. And you've written about this, Anthony, saying, you know, four firms now control more than two-thirds of commercial seed and pesticide sales. How is consolidation in the seed industry affecting farmers and people who eat, consumers?
Right. Yes. Thanks, Jane. Thank you for the comment. I think, well, you have these well-known cases like this farmer in Canada who, I mean, there's a lot of stories, really, but, you know, this question of, there's a lot of ways that we can talk about consolidation and the problems that it poses. Like, one thing, yeah, that when four firms, like I mentioned, oh, the farmer in Canada, you have this case of a person who, I believe at the time was Monsanto. Monsanto's not, you know, is now purchased from Bayer, that, you know, the pharmaceutical company. Right there, you can see that there's this connection with chemical companies, pharmaceuticals, and seed and agriculture. But Monsanto at the time, I believe, was doing some investigations, found some plants growing on this person's farm, some crops, and that you know, probably perhaps for drift or something, like the seeds, plants had gotten to this guy's property, and then they ended up suing him for basically stealing. There's movies made about it and so on. The person didn't steal anything. It's that, you know, the way that plants, you know, the way that seeds move in the air and so on. You know, that's how nature works. And so there's a way that patents and then the patenting of seeds, the genetically modified seeds, like
makes
that,
it illegal for farmers to save and replant genetically engineered seeds.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Yep. And then when they, in terms of consolidation, also in terms of, like I mentioned, with price and so on, we see, like, you can see, like, when four firms control an industry, there's a research that came out of the University of Missouri, Columbia, I believe, Mary Hendrickson and a group of people who worked there. They found that, and their research is all over the internet. You can find it and search articles and whatever, but they find that when four firms control over 40% of a certain industry, then we start seeing, like, essentially illegal practices emerge it can be anything, pork, but seeds included. Then you see price fixing, or you even see, like, price leading. Basically, you know, like, maybe firms don't, you know, we're not talking about a boardroom. People get together, they have a phone call. Like, what are you charging? Not necessarily that. What they're doing, though, is, like, they notice because the markets are so thin.
Yes, Anthony, thank you so much for joining us, and we appreciate you explaining. Anthony Ponke, Vice President of the Wisconsin-based organization Family Farm Defenders. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.